that lecture I'm giving now, the discussion I will lead you in now, is a preparation discussion where I'll be directly answering some of the questions and criticisms that have been raised in Mr. Brigham's book on apologetics about the transcendental method of arguing and Dr. Van Til's presuppositional approach to apologetics. I'm afraid, as I teach apologetics at the study center and lecture on this around the country, that the terminology that is used in evangelical circles has proven to be very misleading about schools of apologetics. I call this evangelical meta-apologetics. It's my conviction, and more on this later as well, it's my conviction that evangelicals, and especially Reformed evangelicals, spend a great deal on apologetics and not nearly enough time doing apologetics. But in the great amount of time that we give to meta-apologetics, the discussion of comparison of schools of apologetics, proper approach, and so forth, what has happened is that we have ended up with a misleading way of looking at the big issue between two schools in the 20th century. If there is good news, sociologically speaking, it is that I think that these two schools are talking to each other much more politely, much more sympathetically, and with understanding at the end of the 20th century than they did throughout much of the first half, especially of the 20th century. If you do the history of evangelical apologetics, you probably will be taken back if you look at journal articles and books and the way men wrote about each other, you know, in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. I mean, it just, you would think that it was religious warfare. And I think that some of that has gone away, maybe because certain personalities have gone away, but I think as we get closer to the end of the 20th century, there's a much better spirit about discussing these things. And to us discuss the differences between ourselves in apologetics, it would be good if we got some clarity about what the differences are. And that clarity is being obscured greatly when we think that the two major schools of thought are evidentialism on the one hand and presuppositionalism on the other. At the Study Center, in our master's program, we have two required courses in apologetics, an introduction and then one that's called presuppositional apologetics. And many people start out with studying with us with the idea that, well, presuppositional apologetics, that's the approach that's against evidence, right? We don't want to use evidence in apologetics, that wouldn't be good. And what we want to get away from these people who defend the faith by appealing to evidence, but they do so without any presuppositions. And so you have the presuppositionalists on the one hand, those who emphasize the presuppositions of argument and don't believe you should appeal to evidence, and then you have those people who appeal to evidence and do so as though they had no presuppositions. Well, I'm sure all of you might realize that is a terrible oversimplification and a misleading way of putting it back. These two schools of thought are not separated by what those popular titles might suggest. And so as I speak to you today, now and after lunch, I'll be referring to the method many people call evidentialism as simply the traditional approach. I'm not going to bother to get into debates over the history of apologetics and how traditional it is. But the fact is, when I grew up as a believer in Jesus Christ and started an interest in defense of the faith, what I ran into over and over and over again until someone finally told me I shouldn't refer to as Van Til, I think I'll just call that the traditional approach. It was traditional for me until I hope that there was a big jump in sanctification, and Van Til taught me something about the lordship of Christ and reasoning. So the traditional approach and the presuppositional approach are indeed distinct from each other, and I believe that the differences between these two schools are penetrating differences. They are not minimal, they're not shallow in significance. Those of you who have read your instructor's book, be aware that on page 83, 5, Mr. Frame tells us, says, on this account of transcendental direction, negative argumentation, certainty, and point of contact, there is less distance between Van Til's apologetics and the traditional apologetics than most partisans on either side, including Van Til himself, have been willing to grant. I am not at all saddened by this implication. This way of thinking opens to the presuppositional apologists many and perhaps all of those arguments generally associated with the traditional apologetics in the past. Now, I may get through my discussion, and Mr. Frame could very well say, yeah, there are differences, but they're not as big as you think they are. And so this may come down to just one of these, well, is it short or is it long? Well, it depends on your perspective. And I'll be interested to see what Mr. Frame says about that myself. So I don't want you to think that I'm starting out thinking that I'm proving that Mr. Frame was wrong in that assessment. But I do think that, at least if I look at the way that I teach and what I try to warn people about, I do think that I'm less inclined to say we have the door open to the traditional arguments than Mr. Frame would. And I'd like to highlight for you 7 characteristics of the traditional method which sets it off from presuppositional apologetics. And so I'm going to give you 7 points. If you're going to be taking notes, I'll repeat them slowly after I introduce them. After each one of the points, I'd like to illustrate from traditional apologetics that this is a point that is not just one of these, you know, bad attitude type things, whereas presuppositionalism assumed the worst of our opponents. I'd like to quote these people to say, this really is what you're looking to do, and I think it's objectionable. So, first of all, I'll go through the 7 points quickly so you see what we're going to be covering, and go back and look at each one of them. These are 7 ways that I think are philosophically profound and critical ways in which traditional apologetics differs from what Dr. Van Til has taught us. First of all, the traditional approach to apologetics assumes that sinners can be and ought to be intellectually autonomous and religiously neutral in approaching, examining, and reasoning about the truth claims of Christianity. Secondly, the traditional method assumes that presuppositions, what we call quote-unquote presuppositions, are merely hypotheses to be tested by factual observation rather than a person's most fundamental assumptions, functioning as preconditions of intelligibility in terms of which hypotheses are tested. Thirdly, the traditional approach assumes that there are group observational common facts outside of any interpretive theory by which hypotheses can be tested. Fourth, the traditional approach proceeds as though the unbeliever, in terms of his own professed philosophical perspective, has intelligible concepts or standards by which he may judge, test, or verify the Christian hypotheses. Fifth, the traditional approach appeals to such concepts or standards that I just mentioned, presumed to be commonly understood or interpreted, and is thus uncontroversial as yet, as a basis for a line of argument which leads the unbeliever, if he would simply reason cogently out of his unbelieving perspective, into the antithetical conclusions of Christianity. Sixth, the traditional approach portrays and defends aspects or parts of Christian worldview in a way which is not distinctively Christian in conception, as though they are truths which may be properly understood in isolation from the overall worldview and is thus theoretically compatible with some other presumably similar worldviews. And then finally, seventhly, the traditional approach proposes only to show that the truth of Christianity is highly probable rather than infallible or certain. Okay, so that's where we're going to be going. Let me go back to the first one and we'll discuss this. The first observation that I would make is that the traditional approach assumes that sinners can be and ought to be, these are 2 points, can be and ought to be intellectually autonomous and religiously neutral in approaching or in examining or in reasoning about the truth claims of Christianity. Now, that may not, for rhetorical purposes, be the best way I can. I'm not so sure that just to frame the scene how big the difference there is. Because, you see, it's on this point that Mr. Frame hammers as well as anybody I've ever read against the traditional approach. This book is wonderful in that regard, in my estimation. We can look at a number of things in the book, but on page 86, Mr. Frame tells us, certainly I have not removed all the differences between Van Til and his critics. And then he adds, the issue of neutrality is still a high barrier between the two schools of thought, and on that matter, Van Til is definitely right. And later on, I'll be saying some more about what Mr. Frame tells us about neutrality and autonomy and so forth. He and I would be, like two peas in a pod in terms of criticizing the traditional method on this matter. The traditional method assumes that men can be neutral and they ought to be autonomous in drawing their conclusions. Let me give you a few quotations from E.J. Carnell, who I think is a good example of the traditional method. I'll be later referring to Francis Schaeffer as well. They're not the only ones I'll refer to, but I want to tell you what my strategy is in choosing Carnell and Schaeffer. The interesting thing is in the 20th century apologetics, when you look at people doing surveys and comparisons of schools, they will often put Schaeffer and Carnell in the presuppositional category. And at times, both Schaeffer and Carnell spoke of themselves as reasoning presuppositionally. And so if I can use them to illustrate what I call the traditional method, hopefully you can see how strong the point really is. I haven't gone to the really easy examples, like shooting fish in a barrel. And you can pick out John Moore of Montgomery and get some outrageous sorts of remarks. So they're going to think, well, of course you're going to go, to Bishop Butler or to Thomas Aquinas. But I think you look at how we can call presuppositionalists, they make our points as well. And on this point, Mr. Frame and I are in total agreement. Dr. Van Til obviously taught us both in this, that the appeal to autonomy and the presumption of neutrality that we find in the traditional approach are utterly unacceptable, and they do that does set off that approach from presuppositionalism. I'm going to quote Carnell in The Philosophy of the Christian Religion. That's a book he published in 1952. He says, there are moments when man is free to evaluate one ultimate over against another with a genuine, though never absolute, freedom from prejudice. There are moments when people can be virtually free from prejudice. And then his introduction to Christian apologetics in 1948, he tells us, a normal person does not submit his life to any authority until, guided by reason, he is fully assured in his mind that the authority in question. In his Christian Commitment, an apologetic published in 1957, Carnell says, but thinking individuals will not outrage their dignity by defying the verdict of a critically disciplined understanding. Whatever else faith may be, it is at least a resting of the mind in the sufficiency of evidences. The extent of this sufficiency is measured by a cool and dispassionate use of reason. The one thing you can give to Carnell, he certainly was adept at expressing this dramatically and very clearly. And he outright says, there's no way you're going to accept even God speaking on the basis of it being God speaking. No authority is accepted just because it has authority. It's the cool, dispassionate use of reason. And when you have those better moments, when you compare the ultimates, we would say presuppositions, that challenge you, you can put aside your prejudices and rational man. I suppose the best known quotation from Carnell, though expressing this point of view, is in his introduction on page 178, where he says, bring on your revelations. Let them make peace with the law of contradiction and the facts of history, and they will deserve a rational man's assent. So here you have the traditional approach, the portrayal to the young believer that he has the right to be and he has the ability to be neutral with respect to ultimate commitments and presuppositions, and that his religiously neutral, dispassionate use of reason will be the judge by which he should accept any purported revelation. And so my first point is the traditional method here illustrated with Carnell assumes that sinners can be and ought to be intellectually autonomous and religiously neutral in approaching, examining, and reasoning about the truth claims of truth. This hasn't been all that controversial. Let's move on, because we're going to start making some points that might indicate a difference that needs to be talked out between us all. Secondly, the traditional method assumes that presuppositions are merely hypotheses to be tested by factual observation or logic rather than a person's most fundamental assumptions functioning as preconditions of intelligibility, in terms of which hypotheses are tested. By way of summary, you can keep track of where we're going as I develop this. The first point has been about autonomy and neutrality. The second, which I see very few people discussing when they do analysis or book reviews and so forth, is what's called the traditional approach or the classical approach. Don't understand presuppositions in the same way that presuppositionalists do. There's the whole question of what you mean by a presupposition has been obscured. And for that reason, I think we talk past each other many times. And the assumption of the traditional approach is that if we're going to deal with presuppositions, traditionalists knew that, what we are dealing with are hypotheses that are tested by factual observation or logic. We're not dealing with what, of course, the presuppositional school is talking about. We're not dealing with a person's most fundamental assumptions in terms of which hypotheses are tested. In particular, we're not dealing with a person's most fundamental assumptions as they function as preconditions of intelligibility. That's the transcendental direction, of course, of Van Til's apologetic. But even forgetting that, which is a side or an extra layer, if you want, of discussion, the fact is that many times traditionalists, when they talk about presuppositions, are talking about things which are tested rather than those commitments that give us the standards for testing. To quote Carnell again in Christian Commitment, he says, if one will proceed to reality with a humble attitude, he will discover that the presuppositions of Christianity are friendly to the highest test of reason. And in his introduction to Christian apologetics, it says the Christian believes the postulate of a rational God to be a workable hypothesis in the light of the evidence. And then a very clear example from Francis Schaeffer in his book, He Is There, He Is Not Silent. Now, I'll read this slowly. I want you to pick up on this. I still remember the first day I read that book back in 1972. And I read the sentence, and I could not believe that Schaeffer had made this big a mistake. But here, I will say also that I have a high regard for Francis Schaeffer and what he's accomplished in his ministry, so don't take any of this personally. But it is a huge mistake. Schaeffer says, what I urge people to do is to consider the two great presuppositions, the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system and the uniformity of natural causes in an open system, and to consider which of these fits the facts of what is. And as I have said, it is a question of which of these two sets of presuppositions really and empirically meets the facts as we look about us in the world. And so the point here is that on the traditional approach, if you're going to talk about presuppositions, what you're talking about is hypotheses, or fundamental hypotheses, or wide-ranging hypotheses, but hypotheses subject to testing. But then Till talked about presuppositions. He's not the only one, but he talked about presuppositions, those basic commitments in terms of which the standards of testing are determined. So you don't test your presuppositions in the same way that you test, say, a hypothesis that smoking causes cancer. On the traditional approach, you see, on this view of presuppositions, Christianity has no special epistemic status. Christianity is tested like everything else. So that if the unbeliever has the proper standards, his epistemology, or the proper method for knowing anything at all, he just uses the same standards and same method that he uses everywhere else. And we can make a list of the things that the unbeliever believes. What the apologist does is he says, use those standards or those methods and then add to your set of beliefs another one, namely, that Christianity is true. So Christianity, or the presupposition of Christianity, turns out not to have any special epistemic status. It too is tested and tested like everything else. Carnell says, why should faith be exempted from the general rule that all belief is subjected to the law of contradiction in the light of the facts of history? What higher floor in the building of knowledge is there than coherence? By the way, for Carnell, coherence means more than logical coherence. But what he's saying is, you do to the faith what you do to every other hypothesis. Test it according to the general rule. Elsewhere in the philosophy of the Christian religion, he says, if this credible individual be oneself, the man across the street, or God, one should follow exactly the same rule. Okay, so let me repeat that. When the traditional approach refers to presuppositions, it's really referring to something that's closer to what we call a hypothesis, subject to testing. And tested the same way that every other hypothesis. Thirdly, the traditional approach assumes that there are brute, observational, common facts outside of any interpretive theory by which hypotheses can be tested. So the third issue here is going to be our understanding of facts. And as the idealists like to put it, and Van Til often referred to it this way, the traditional approach sees the facts as quote unquote brute. They are not standing within a theory in order to be intelligible, but they are those brute posits that every theory must come to grips with. E.J. Carnell again. Facts just are, he says. Facts just are. A fact is any unit of being which is capable of bearing meaning. It's anything that exists that can bear meaning. Each of these fact situations must be explained as what the mind entertains when it passes judgment upon the facts. Okay, so you have these kind of like brute empty forms out here. Those are the existing things of the world, and then the mind interprets them, and now they have meaning. On this approach, scientific observations are not affected by ultimate presuppositions or commitments. When one engages in science, one is not affected by ultimate presuppositions. On page 214 of his introduction, Carnell says, science seeks for the natural meaning of a thing. The natural meaning of a thing. Scientific conclusions as such do not depend for their meaning upon one's logical starting point. As long as the scientist confines his judgments to an impersonal description of what objectively exists in the world of flux, the problem of common ground has no relevance. And indeed, facts are more ultimate than worldviews and can be used to test them. Facts are more ultimate than worldviews and can be used to test them. Here I'll quote Montgomery, he puts it so well. He says very simply, one must move to the fitting of the facts as the ultimate test of a worldview. So worldviews may be tested, and how are they tested? By their fitting the facts, if they do or they don't. Therefore, human experience of the facts verifies the Christian hypothesis on this approach. Carnell again. The mark of an acceptable hypothesis is its ability to explain the facts as we experience them. Is it not good science to postulate the existence of God to account for the known data in human experience? That sentence is real important because what he's saying very explicitly is that there is data, there are facts between human experience, and that is known, and it's on that basis that we postulate the existence of God. Okay? So what is epistemically sure here is my experience of the facts. And what's not so sure is this postulate about God explaining the facts. Schaeffer says in The God Who Was There, the question is, does the Christian answer conform to and explain what we observe concerning man as he is, including my knowledge of myself as man? And then later in the same book, Schaeffer says, we are not asked to believe until we have faced the question as to whether this is true on the basis of space-time evidence. I suppose one thing that discourages me working in epistemology for my PhD is that this is so crucial to Christian apologetics, and Christians come right up to the edge of discussing these matters, but they often don't seem to know what is going on in terms of the epistemological issues. I mean, there's an anatomy of epistemology, if you will, different schools of epistemology, and one gets the impression that Schaeffer and Carnell and others just kind of wandered into this particular approach. It's not the only one available, and it's certainly not in the 20th century the most credible approach to epistemology. But if you take these two points together, I'm going to try to schematize for you what's going on so that no one gets lost here. Let's assume that a worldview of these various geometric sorts. So they are different from each other. You can tell you have a square, a circle, and a triangle. And the idea is that the hypotheses, and that there's something that's outside of these worldviews, just these posits we'll call facts. And the way in which we decide what is true is that we try to fit that hypothesis onto the facts. And I purposely drawn it this way so I wouldn't, you know, prejudice to give it away. The question is now, given the ambiguity of the configuration of the facts, which of these worldviews best accounts for them? And then, I mean, we can get into the details of the apologetical argument. Oftentimes it's embarrassingly bad. I remember, you know, being at USC and studying and having evangelical, you know, brothers and sisters, people that I love, watching them argue with other people in the philosophy department, with professors, and giving arguments that are just horrible arguments, really. I mean, I'm a Christian, and I'm embarrassed by how bad these arguments are. We can get into that, but that is the point, that these are bad arguments. I want you to see what the nature of the argument is. The argument assumes that you can have facts that are not understood according to a theory, that they stand outside of worldviews, to use the popular parlance, and that worldviews or presuppositions are just like to be tested. They're hypotheses that you take up against these brute facts to see which is best. Fourthly, the traditional approach proceeds as though the unbeliever, in terms of his own professed philosophical perspective, has intelligible concepts or standards by which he may judge, test, or verify the Christian hypotheses. Let me read that again, it's a long one. It proceeds as though the unbeliever, in terms of his own professed philosophical perspective, I need to emphasize here, his professed philosophical perspective. So when the unbeliever tells you what he thinks he believes about reality, about knowledge, about ethics, whatever, In terms of that professed perspective, he has intelligible concepts or standards that he can use to judge the Christian hypothesis. And I'm just going to write down concepts and standards here as the issue. The issue is, are the concepts and standards that we talked to the unbeliever about, or which he proposes, intelligible, given what he professes? And the traditional method just takes it for granted that the believer and the unbeliever can talk about causation, can talk about logic, can talk about moral absolutes, and that the unbeliever can make perfectly good sense out of what we're talking about then, given his professed perspective. Okay, so we have another issue. Not just how we understand the facts, but how do we understand concepts and standards? My hope is some of you in this room have listened to some of the public debates I've done. The one that that many have heard with Gordon Stein is an illustration of, not the way I did it, I hope, but many people would say, well, we can take the standard of the laws of logic and simply go out there and try to find out, now, whose hypothesis is more logical? Well, one deals with facts outside of theories, outside of presupposed worldviews. And can unbelievers make intelligible the concepts like causation or the standards like the laws of logic that we want to, you know, use to test these hypotheses? Francis Schaeffer says in the church at the end of the 20th century, we must strain through the grid of reason everything that comes into our mind. The grid of reason is out there. As though we could make intelligible the grid of reason and use that to strain everything that will finally, I take this as a metaphor, come into our mind, meaning that we will assent to as being true. Schaeffer says in his lecture, Historic Christianity and 20th Century Man, in 1965, there must be a pre-evangelism before evangelism is meaningful to 20th century people. This pre-consideration falls into two areas. The first is in the area of epistemology. I'll break the quote at that point, because that's what I want you to see. Pre-evangelism involves epistemology. Issues pertaining to our theory of knowledge precede evangelism. Okay, we first have concepts and standards that are intelligible. And if you're familiar with Schaeffer's work, all of you know how much it's important to him that we get back to the Greek notion of antithesis and the law of non-contradiction and those sorts of things. We don't want to do what the Hegelians and post-Hegelians did and engage in synthesis reasoning. I'm convinced Schaeffer did not understand Hegel, does a very poor job portraying him. But let's at least understand where Schaeffer's coming from. Schaeffer says, we can, before we test Christianity, we got to get rid of this post-Hegelian synthesis thinking and get everybody back to the Greeks. And then once you're back to the Greeks, then you can present the gospel to them and make sense out of it. Yeah, but I wonder whether an unbeliever can make sense out of the Greek concept of logic. And the God who was there, he says, before a man is ready to become a Christian, he must have a proper understanding of truth. And then, again, in his lecture on Historic Christianity and 20th Century Man, the Bible as a system must stand openly and by itself in the arena, in the forum of the thought of men. Never, never, never will I say, you must believe it because the Bible teaches it. We cannot expect 20th century men to take the authority of the Scripture as a reason for believing the Christian system. And I have to admit, because of my affection and admiration for Dr. Schaeffer, that even I had to go back and look at that quote again and say, did he really say that? And we can talk about how these mistakes were made sometime. And I think it's only fair to tell you that this is not Schaeffer at his best, and not characteristically Schaeffer either. But he does show, I think, these elements, these problems that I'm putting on the board here. He said, Never, never, never will I say you must believe it because the Bible teaches it. We cannot expect 20th century men to take the authority of the Scripture as a reason for believing the Christian system. So the Christian worldview isn't to be believed because of the authority of the Scripture. Never will I say that to them. Well, he did say it, praise God, but here he tells us we shouldn't. And then in the God who was there, he says, the truth that we let in first is not a dogmatic statement of the truth of the Scriptures, but the truth of the external world and the truth of what man himself is. This, I am convinced, is the true order for our apologetics in the second half of the 20th century. Okay? So there is something that is more intelligible, somebody might even say more authoritative, but certainly in isolation from the Christian worldview, in isolation commitment, it is intelligible to appeal to, the truth of the external world and the truth of what man himself is. Those things can be made intelligible outside of Christian commitment. E.J. Carnell, all three tenses to revelation must be put through a scrutinizing test. The Bible should be tested in the light of relevant criteria. And then elsewhere, like any hypothesis, special revelation is verified when it results in an implicative system which is horizontally self-consistent and which vertically fits the facts, logic, and historical evidence. The only proof anyone can offer, both for his system of philosophy and for the actions which flow from it, is systematic coherence, that is, a worldview that accords to the law of contradiction and the concrete facts of history. And then he goes on, it is in this that the Christian offers proof for his system. Let me say it again. The only proof anyone can offer, both for his system of philosophy and for the actions which flow from it, is systematic coherence. It is in this framework that the Christian offers proof for his system. So again, systematic coherence, however that has to be defined and so forth, is some kind of standard, there's some kind of concept here which is intelligible apart from Christianity and in terms of which the system of Christianity is proven. He says, faith must be founded in objectively verifiable metaphysical theories. In Christian commitment, Carnell says, if the meaning of God's character cannot be anticipated by information drawn from our own conception of decency, what significance is conveyed by the term God? So we have Carl was very, I think, woolly and ambiguous. I mean, apologetics of the heart, as it's sometimes called. When he did his Christian commitment apologetic, he wanted to appeal to a notion of decency, of moral decency. And he said that that notion of decency precedes any commitment to Christianity, and only in terms of that intelligible concept or standard can Christianity be seen to be true. In A Philosophy of the Christian Religion, he said, the reason why we are able to trust Christ is that he spoke and lived in a way which is congenial with our axiological expectations. Jesus Christ is worthy of our faith because both his person and his doctrine are rationally continuous with the values which we have already accepted in ordinary experience. I really do want to promote a charitable attitude among ourselves as we discuss schools of apologetics. When I wrote a long essay on Carnell, I had three long pages of quotations of excellent material from him, so please don't be mistaken. But you do have to wonder when you hear a book like this, how can a scholar get so lost in his study, apparently, that he can get this far off the mark? We accept Jesus only because he's rationally continuous with what we already expect from ordinary experience. Well, there's no offense to the gospel at all, then, isn't it? Jesus is just the most reasonable step anybody would ever take. Jesus never offends our sensibilities. Carnell said those sorts of things. I'm sure he didn't really believe that. I mean, he didn't worked that out consistently. But that is what is portrayed in the traditional methods, what we should be doing. We should use concepts or standards which are intelligible, given the unbeliever's professed philosophy, rationally continuous with his ordinary experience, appeal to facts which are in and of themselves group, not part of the art, interpreted by presuppositions, and use these things then to test the hypothesis of Christianity in an autonomous way, being neutral in our attitude. And so the fifth point here kind of draws this together. The traditional approach then appeals to such concepts or standards mentioned in number four, presumed to be commonly understood or interpreted, and thus uncontroversial as yet, appeals to such concepts or standards, has a basis for a line of argument which leads the unbeliever, if he would simply reason cogently out of his unbelieving perspective, into the antithetical conclusions of Christianity. Okay, remember that the standards we're appealing to, a really easy one would be the laws of life, because most Christians, in fact, most presuppositionals, I think, haven't thought this one through very well. Everything's logic. And there's no interpretive differences there. We don't have to worry about that. So we can appeal to the standard of logic, let's say, and we presume that it's commonly understood and interpreted. And for that reason, what we're appealing to is not yet controversial. No one should, you know, get agitated at the beginning of our apologetics. We're appealing to things that are, you have this really strange language of common ground in Reformed discussions, but that's just common ground, okay? We can go out there and everybody understands the same thing, no controversy yet, and then use that as the basis for a line of argument which leads the unbeliever, if only he do his homework correctly. The unbeliever's problem is just that he hasn't reasoned clearly enough. Use those concepts or those standards to lead the unbeliever out of his unbelieving perspective into the antithetical conclusions of Christianity just by reasoning properly. That traditional method of apologetics, or at least that's what is hoped to be accomplished, that's the conception of what's being done by the traditional apologists. Schaefer says in The God Who Was There, Christian apologetics do not start somewhere beyond the stars. They begin with man and what he knows about himself. He knows something of the external world, and he knows something of himself. Now notice in this the stark similarity to Thomistic scholasticism. Reason operating in the realm of nature is a vestibule to faith. And though most of these writers will usually say something about there being a little bit of a bump there when you go from the realm of natural reason to supernatural faith or the realm of grace. The fact is, it's a small step, we can speak comparatively, because if you use your reason properly and understand the realm of nature, you know that he's a God, you know that he's intelligent, you know a number of things. It all depends on how much you can find out from natural reason, but
Point five.
Yeah, what I'm giving you is 0.5.
Okay, but it wasn't on the board, so
I can. I didn't use this expression in the way that I put it, but for the sake of abbreviating it, we've been talking about common notions. Okay. The traditional approach appeals to common notions, ask the unbeliever to reason cogently on the basis of them into the antithetical conclusions of Christianity. I'm trying to abbreviate a lot of this short way of putting it. Let me read. The traditional method appeals to such concepts or standards presumed to be commonly understood or interpreted, and thus uncontroversial as yet, as a basis for a line of argument which leads the unbeliever, if he would simply reason cogently, out of his unbelieving perspective into the antithetical conclusions of Christianity. And I was noting here the similarity to Thomistic scholasticism, the idea that reason operating in the realm of nature is what a vestibule to faith. B.B. Warfield is an excellent illustration of this. In his introduction to Francis Beattie's Apologetics, Warfield wrote, "Surely the unbeliever must first have the scriptures authenticated to him as such before he can take his standpoint in them. Faith has its grounds in right reason." Can't ask the unbeliever to stand protected with the scriptures until he's first convinced by right reason that this is God speaking in this book called the scriptures. E.J. Carmel says, "First we know rationally in order that we might believe. Then we believe in order that we might know experientially." Carmel is clever that way. But, you know, when you have to choose between the Augustinian and the Thomistic approaches to the faith reason issue, the Augustinian approach is often captured in Augustine's statement, "I believe in order to understand." And so the question is, well, do we believe first that we might understand, or do we understand first that we might believe? Carmel says, well, it's both. First you understand or know rationally, so that you might believe what the Bible says. And then believing what the Bible says, you'll come to know it experientially. So it kind of splits the difference even from the cost of equivocation logically. But his approach is that rationally we know in order that we might believe. And then Schaeffer, at one of his, not one of his better moments, says, and I quote, "Knowledge precedes faith. Only the faith which believes God on the basis of knowledge is true faith." Okay, so if you're going to say you have faith in Christ, you believe the Bible, the only genuine article is the one that first knows these things to be true. And thus the unbeliever's perspective, I'm still in number 5, the unbeliever's perspective is seen as all right as far as it goes, but needs to be taken further. Okay? There is this rational vestibule for faith. And we can appeal to the common notions of reason or human experience. And then if we reason cogently, as Warfield said, using right reason, we can move the unbeliever in faith. He begins by knowing things, he moves into the realm of faith. Well, that assumes that the unbeliever's perspective, epistemologically anyway, or philosophically, is all right as far as it goes. He's just not correct about religion. So I quote Carmel. By the way, Carmel said these words originally. He later used them in his Christian Commitment Apologetic, but he originally wrote these words in the Christian Century, reviewing Van Til's The Defense of the Faith. And he said, "Like a ship which has 10 good days at sea, but sinks on the 11th, so paganism develops profound truths in various spheres, only to fail in answering how a man may be just with God." So the pagan ship is good for 10 days and all these other areas of life, but on the 11th day when we come to religion, how are you right with God? It sinks. And Christianity cannot complete what is valid in the wisdom of the ages, then the unbeliever will be offended, not challenged, by the gospel. He will spew out any system that negates elements which by nature and common sense are foundations of the true, the good, and the beautiful. That's a great quote. What he's saying is the unbeliever's got the foundations for the true, the good, and the beautiful. And if you come along and say he doesn't have them, he'll be offended. You know, what's funny about that is you would have thought Carmel would have said, well, isn't that what the Bible says happens when you witness to Jesus Christ? The unbeliever's offended. And I think, honestly, this is one of the geniuses of what Van Til has taught us, is that if we use the proper epistemological approach, people will be offended by that. You see, you're saying that I don't really know things about the world, or about logic, or about morality, apart from your world. People say, yeah, you're saying it. And Carnell says, that's what you must not do. One more time. Like a ship which has 10 good days at sea but sinks on the 11th, so paganism develops profound truths and barriers only to fail in answering how a man may be just with God. If Christianity cannot complete what is valid in the wisdom of the ages, then the unbeliever will be offended, not challenged, by the gospel. He will spew out any system that negates elements which, by nature and common sense, did he mean that just in passing in the way that the history of philosophy refers to the common school of thought, or did he mean that more profoundly? Is this a sense which is common to all men? Common sense. They'll speak out any system that negates elements which by nature and common sense are foundations of the truth of good and beautiful. In Christian Commitment, he wrote, some apologists try to safeguard the finality of Christianity by repudiating the possibility of truth outside of Christianity. I'm sure he meant the possibility of knowledge rather than truth, but their effort, as one might suspect, Christ himself defended degrees of truth in the natural man. Non-Christians can develop relative truths about nature and life, but they cannot answer the profound question, how can a sinner be just before God? And one more quote. And is this a good time for a break?
Yeah, would be good. Yeah.
Okay, one short quote. From the philosophy of the Christian religion, again, Carnell. While rejecting the humanistic ideal as incomplete, therefore, Christ nevertheless built upon its insights rather than derogating it as untruth. What's crucial there is this notion that the unbelieving worldview, the humanistic ideal, is incomplete, and we need to take what's there, this is what Jesus did according to him, and build on it rather than derogate it. Okay, why don't we go ahead and take your normal break and come back and finish. The traditional method treats the unbeliever's perspective as all right as far as it goes, but needs further, that's what we just talked about. And implicit in this is the view that there is a wisdom or an intelligence, there is a science, if you want to call it that, that is common to the believer and the unbeliever. E.J. Carnell says, in the case of Orthodox theology, general wisdom is not a threat to the gospel. Aristotle said many wise things about logic. Confucius, many wise things about morals. When a Christian attacks general wisdom in the name of the gospel, the natural man will attack the gospel in the name of general wisdom. Okay, so, by the way, I was directed at Dr. Dantil personally. Don't you dare tell the unbeliever he doesn't have general wisdom, because then he'll take all the things he knows and he'll use it to attack the gospel. Well, more on whether we should worry about that very much. The Bible is verified thus by common concepts and standards thinking our reasoning elsewhere. Carnell says, back in 1948, truth is systematically construed meaning. And if the Bible fulfills this standard, it is just as true as Lambert's law of transmission. Francis Schaeffer says in The God Who Was There, in a chapter entitled, by the way, How Do We Know It Is True? He says, scientific proof, philosophical proof, and religious proof follow the same rules. The theory must be non-contradictory and must give an answer to the phenomena in question. We must be able to live consistently with our theory. The answer must conform to what we observe. Okay, remember, what he says is this is the same method of proof in science, philosophy, and religion. I don't know a modern philosopher who would agree with that. And although there are some scientists, philosophy of science, I don't want to say there are no scientists who say that, very few scientists who think that they are using the same method, and philosophers are using the same method, and theologians are using the same method. Much less do any of those at the end of the 20th century, as far as I know, think that the method we follow is test things by non-contradiction, whether you can live with this, and if it conforms to what you observe. But Schaeffer says that's what we're doing. And in the same book, two pages later,
he asks or indicates what he thinks demonstrates the truth of historic Christianity, and his answer is, Christianity constitutes a non-self-contradictory answer that does explain the phenomena and which can be lived with both in life and scholarly pursuits. Okay, so number five, just to bring us back on board here, was that the traditional approach appeals to such concepts or standards which are presumed to be commonly understood or interpreted, and thus uncontroversial as yet, as for a line of argument which leads the unbeliever, if he would simply reason cogently, out of his unbelieving perspective into the antithetical conclusions of Christianity. Number six, the traditional method portrays and defends aspects or parts of the Christian worldview in a way which is not distinctively Christian in conception. I'll say that slowly. Not distinctively Christian in conception. The way in which these aspects of the worldview, the way they're portrayed, is not distinctively Christian. As though they are truths which may be properly understood in isolation from the overall worldview, and as thus theoretically compatible with some other presumably similar worldviews. And I labor hard to say this precisely because I think there's a lot of talking past each other this issue in apologetical or meta-apologetical arguments. The problem, it seems to me, according to Van Til, with the traditional method is that not so much that it doesn't prove everything at one time. You know, it's like the whole shooting match has to be talked about at once, and no one's capable of doing that. That isn't really the problem. The problem is that those elements of the Christian worldview which are defended in the traditional approach, those elements are portrayed as though they're not distinctively Christian notions. Okay. So if we say everything has a cause, or every event has a cause, the traditional method doesn't have any difficulty in saying God is the cause of the universe as a whole. As though the notion of cause, where God is now the creator cause, is really consistent with Aristotle's notion of causation as well. That element of the Christian system, by the way, it is true, the Christian system teaches God caused the world. God created the world, no doubt about that. And if that's all the cosmological argument were about, there wouldn't have ever been an argument about it. I mean, who could complain? It would have simply been preaching. God is the creator of the world. But to say, and we can prove this by appealing to something which is understood outside the Christian system and congenial to Aristotle and to, well, any number of other schools of philosophy, has disturbed some theorists, certainly disturbed Van Til, and that differentiates what Van Til trying to do from what, let's say, Warfield or Geisler or whoever else are trying to do. Now, I want to make very clear, you may believe that what Van Til says here is wrong. Maybe he is. I don't think he is. But if he is, the important point here is what he's attempting to do and what he understands by what he's doing is not at all what the traditional approach claims to be doing. The traditional approach portrays and defends aspects of the Christian worldview in a way which is not distinctively Christian in conception, but rather somehow, we don't want to say neutral, we're going to start using that word too often and we're going to lose its value, but the notion that we're defending, or the idea of God causing the world, whatever it may be, is not uniquely indexed to the Christian theory. And it works, it functions intelligibly in other theories as well. That's the offensive thing. As though they are truths which may be properly understood in isolation from the overall worldview, or properly understood as theoretically compatible with some other worldviews. Not compatible with all of the worldviews, but there are some worldviews that are compatible with this in addition to Christianity. And thus, presumably, what you have here, again, I'm going to give you a visual picture that doesn't offer philosophical precision, but I think what Vantil was quite upset about is the notion that you have a Christian worldview, and then you have other worldviews that overlap it, really. And there may be other ones that overlap that, and so forth. So that when we try to use something that is common to all of them, to prove the Christian worldview, in order to buy time or to gain the acceptance of the unbeliever, thus far in the argument, we have to portray this common element as somehow compatible with all these worlds, Christianity. And then what the apologist does, if he does his job well on the traditional method, is that having, you know, bought your acceptance of this, and the idea that it is compatible with various worldviews, of course not the ones out here, that's ruled out. Then you start eliminating these other possibilities, and then what you're left with is Christianity. But what that tells you, if you're a Vantilian, is that what you were talking about here was not a distinctively Christian notion of causation or creation, or a distinctively Christian notion of miracle. That may be an even better illustration if you look at the way in which miracles are defended in the traditional approach to Christianity. It's nearly hair-raising if you're a philosopher to see how evangelical believers can give a notion of miracle to the unbeliever and have him buy into that, which is not at all the biblical concept of miracle. Anyway, what happens then is that Christianity comes to be defended piece by piece. You have broad theism. I mean, this is, you can see this, and Mr. Frame refers to this in his book as well. Usually you have broad theism defended, then you have historic Christianity defended. Or you have theism in general. I try to make it a habit. Mr. Frame may think I'm wrong, but I try to make a habit of telling people when I do apologetics, I am not defending theism in general. In fact, I don't even think it makes sense to talk about theism in general. And then you move to a Unitarian conception, and then a Trinitarian conception. Or you defend the idea of personality as something that's common to God and man, and we see it in our experience somehow in the universe, and then in God. Love, intelligence, causality, miracles I just mentioned. We defend the idea that man is a physical creature. And we defend him as a spiritual, we defend him as a free creature. We defend him as a dignified creature. We defend Christ as a good man, as a miracle worker, as right.